Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute, either explicitly or implicitly, any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, and welcome to FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. My name is Brett Winton. I am ARK Invest's chief futurist and host of FYI. With us today, we have Nemo Despot. Nemo is our extraordinaire in all things multi-omics, a PhD out of MIT. He did single-cell genomics research there. He's been on the venture side. He's an amazing guy. Hi, Nemo. How are you?
I'm great, Brett. Excited about this podcast.
So today, Nemo and I are going to talk about multi-omics, and then we have an interview with Faisal Mahmoud, who is a professor at Harvard, and yes, and his work is in taking applying AI to microscope images, basically to pathology, and how kind of pathology could change when you do it computationally and combine it with all other types of data. So Nemo, when we say multi-omics, like, what do we mean by multi-omics?
Yeah, so when we say multi-omics, we basically think about different data that we can get from biological systems. So primarily we think about kind of central dogma, which is the DNA. DNA gets replicated to RNA, and then we have the proteins. So there's like DNA, RNA, and a protein data, but there is also epigenome data, which kind of regulates the expression of the RNA. There is also metabolomics kind of data. So there are different kind of molecular fingerprints or features when we think about kind of multi-omics.
But we also think about I don't know if we've used the word phenomics. Is phenomics a word? Phenotypomics?
Yeah. So that's the kind of, you know, that's the kind of other layer of the equation. So, you know, so basically, in biology generally, like, there is a DNA, which is like a genotype, and then there is like a phenotype. But, you know, some could say that even expression of RNA is a phenotype, you know, and the protein is the phenotype. But the phenotype is the EKG as well, and the phenotype is the image of the tissue. So phenotype is a really broad kind of scope. All of the things that you
and consider. So then a pathological slide, a microscope slide, would you consider that a phenotypic data?
That's a phenotype. Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of phenotypic data.
And so maybe it's better to not think of it all as like phenotypomics, but you have imaging through x-rays and MRIs. You have like a molecular look at what's going on in the cell. You basically have all of these different categories of data or modes of data that when combined actually can provide more powerful understandings of what's going on in the body than we currently have.
Yes, exactly. You know, again, I think the basic premise here is the kind of complexity of the biology, which is a multi-layered kind of system. And there are different systems, and there are different systems that we can be recording the data. And that's why we have this kind of multimodal data. You know, we can be recording the phenotypic data at the level of the organ, tissue, or the whole body, right? Or kind of at the level of the cell, which is the molecular data. And so that's, to understand the complexity, actually, we take this multimodal approach because we have these different recordings and then we try to put them together.
And what would it mean to kind of like the healthcare business landscape if we had a better understanding? Like, at a very high level, we think that AI is actually enabling a lot of this stuff. I don't know if you know this, and in fact, I learned it recently, but the healthcare system, of all sectors, it has the most data. They collect it, they archive it, they don't do that much with it. And gosh, we should be doing a lot more because generally we're not great at healthcare, certainly the US isn't, but and then on a global basis. So if we were able to take AI and apply it to all these different classes of data, where would that lead us potentially?
That will really kind of open a door to different type of the healthcare than we have today, you know, kind of really moving. And we talked about this kind of moving from this kind of sick care model where we are kind of dealing with the disease when it's too late already, but actually kind of being kind of more on the predictive, preventive side where we can actually kind of, you know, see diseases coming much earlier and then actually prevent it. So that's what would be kind of opening. And, you know, I saw this paper even a few years ago that basically the health data is going to be the biggest data, you know, overall, like YouTube and all that. It's like a, such a small amount of the data compared to the kind of health data that, you know, that was existing and it's going to kind of be collected over the years.
Yeah, if you look at, for example, Meta's large open source language model that's trained on 15 trillion tokens worth of text. So that's text data. If you did a token embedding on the genomic data in an intelligent way in the UK Biobank, which only has 500,000 patients in it, that would be, I think it's 400 trillion plus tokens worth of data just in that half million patient sample. And so, it's whatever that works out to 30, 40 times larger than the amount of data that's powering, you know, this incredible, you know, language agent that can do all these magical things. And yet it's clear that we're not yet, at a stage where, or I don't think we are, maybe you could correct me, where kind of like the biological data is being fed in a very robust way into AI models that are yielding us kind of the results, or maybe we're at the very incipient stages.
Yeah, I think we are at the very early stages. And, you know, and also like, you know, it's just like also what you said, this is only 500,000 of kind of whole genomes, kind of, you know, there's 8 billion people, right? So just like how we are little scraping the surface of everything. But yes, I think we are really in the early days of all of this. And, you know, we are seeing different kind of areas, you know, such as kind of, you know, protein structure prediction, for example, you know, here kind of pathology and those kind of image data. I think the sequence and that data is also there. I think we are really at the kind of stage of the early days of the revolution that's going to happen in the healthcare with the AI and this kind of this amount of the data.
Yeah, I think there's a few ways to think about it. One, you know, drug development should get a lot more efficient. There are a few companies that are, you know, very explicitly focused upon using multiomics data to power drug development efforts. In the case of Absci, for example, they claim that they can, you know, half the time and half the cost to go from kind of an idea getting into the clinic where you're actually testing it on humans. And that's where they are today. But the capability of these tools should get more and more powerful. And as you listen to the conversation, you can hear how kind of like just using digital pathology data and combining it with some of these multiomic molecular data sets, you can both make the kind of identification of disease on the pathology side better and better interpret the molecular data coming off of your diagnostic or your multiomic tools. Conceptually at the drug development side, this could lead to much higher returns on R&D capital, where you're not spending as much money to develop one to go after a very specific disease, whereas before maybe you didn't even understand the disease you were going after. And then for some of the drug developer sides, then they have kind of synthetic biological ways that they're developing specifically targeted treatments that they can then plug into the pocket you need to address that disease. And so ultimately you could end up with a sector that actually has done a poor job of stewarding investor capital, take money, inject it to more drug development efforts, which are very expensive and don't yield great returns and falling on average over time, into a sector that actually tips back up into high return on R&D territory, which would be a big change and which we haven't really seen since the 2000s. So that's like one direction I think it could go. And then on the diagnostic side, where could it go there?
Yeah, so I think on the diagnostic side, it really kind of could help us, you know, make things much faster and streamline it and actually really enable this kind of predictive kind of medicine. You know, even today from pathology slides, they look at the images and they'll give their subjective view or like have one or two kind of markers that the pathologists are using to kind of diagnose something. I mean, there is many, much more rich information there that could be used actually to actually better understand the risk profiles, the kind of to which therapies patients would be responding or not. So there is much more there where it can be kind of really, really used, that I would say. And I also just want to say, you know, even for the drug discovery as well, you know, it's a huge accomplishment with the drug discovery, what we kind of do today, but still it's a huge artisanal process, you know, in my mind, it's even like, you know, thinking about the music, classical music, right? Like where, you know, where you play a piano and right, only if you come to a concert, you're going to hear the music and like, where is the music today on everyone's phone and everyone can make it. And like, I want to see that kind of leap in the drug discovery. And I still feel we are like in the classical ages, you know, so that's kind of how I'm thinking.
Yeah. I mean, in the two are paired, diagnostic and discovery, as in you discover, you use these new tools to discover and develop a drug, then that means you need to use the tools to diagnose the patient with the specific thing that that drug is targeted after. And so, you know, upstream of all that is the tool development. Along the way is kind of companies aligning themselves against biological data in interesting ways to develop AI, you know, capabilities. And that could be on the developer side, or it could be someone like Tempus AI, which is, you know, pairing health record data with molecular information coming from cancer patients, you know, and then ultimately downstream for humans, it means you have treatments that just work better and, you know, potentially even cures in some cases.
I mean, Tempus is the one who first got a CPT code for this algorithmic diagnostic, basically, you know, where you kind of have this kind of, and this is, I think, you know, diagnostics kind of having the foundational model as the basically your diagnostic kind of process, you know, which is kind of supervised by a pathologist or someone, but that's kind of where it's going to be the future, right? And, you know, yeah, I think the kind of regulatory hurdles and then reimbursement kind of hurdles, but I think, we see with Tempus, that's changing.
Yeah, it was interesting to me that Professor Mahmoud, you know, was so sensitive to like the payer and regulatory landscape, even at the research side. You know, it seems to be under a great deal of change now, given what's just happened with the election. So, I think at a very high level, you could say there's likely to be, kind of less, regulatory constraint on being able to get, tests and procedures into the marketplace and say, hey, this is what this does. And at least on a time basis, like timeline should be able to shrink. And so then potentially that could accelerate the adoption of these new technologies contra the status quo. The healthcare system is profoundly conservative in terms of uptake of kind of new ideas, in part because it's so liability averse, in part because there's, you know, lots of payment friction and gatekeepers. And it will be interesting to see if like the change in the political environment actually allows some of these things that, you know, some of these truly multimodal AI driven diagnostic tools to actually enter the patient landscape more quickly.
Well, I think it's going to be kind of, you know, I think it's the kind of change on the, you know, with presidential elections and kind of change in the thinking. But I also think now, you know, I think healthcare being kind of very complex problems that they're trying to solve, you know, initial kind of just the digitalization, which kind of happened with kind of digital kind of age and just some of the kind of computational biology was not really enough to solve some of the big issues, but AI actually can do that. And so I think we are now in the real, you know, in the real kind of time of the revolution at the moment because of the AI and the amount of data that we have, because again, the complexity of the problems in the bio, you know, it's something that AI can solve. The previous tools that we had, they were not, you know, at the task like that.
Well, enjoy the conversation, everybody. And thanks for joining FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. Learn a little bit about pathology and all the way into kind of how, you know, AI agents are likely to accelerate the research process.
Welcome back to our podcast for your innovation. Today we are joined with Professor Faisal Mahmood, who is a professor at Mass General and Brigham, and he has been making recently waves in the computational pathology and applying the AI to the pathology. So, you know, maybe where we could just kind of start off is, you know, if you could just tell us a little more about your background and how did you actually started in this kind of area of the kind of computational pathology.
My background is in computer science and biomedical engineering. I did a postdoc at Johns Hopkins where I started working on applying machine learning to medical images. In the beginning, it was for endoscopy and then slowly gravitated towards pathology. And the thing that was most interesting for me was that pathology at the time was basically the only modality in medicine that was not already digital. So pathology images were just getting started to be digitized, and it was quite clear that it would be a wealth of data, and it's largely unexplored data. We don't know what kind of correlates we would find with outcomes. Image-based biomarkers were just coming up, so that's how I got started, and I've been working in this area for about 6 years now.
Oh, so what time frame was that where you first got into digital pathology?
Yeah, so it was around 2017. I started the research lab here at Mass General and at Harvard at around 2019.
I remember at the time we were looking at image classification getting really good. And I remember I had a friend who was a radiologist. I was like, oh, are you worried about your job? You know, because what does a radiologist do? What does a pathologist do? A radiologist, it's looking at an imaging study and being like, well, here's the cancer. Pathology, it's the same. You're looking under a microscope and you're like, here's the cancerous cell. And in some ways, that's certainly radiologists haven't lost their jobs. And I actually have been maybe even a little puzzled that the rate pace of advance of enhancing radiology pathology with image classification hasn't happened more quickly. Is that a misperception on my side, or is it just more complex than from a lay observer's perspective it actually would appear?
It is quite complex. So a lot of what pathologists often do is not just looking at one image and making a determination. Often it's inherently multimodal. So they're looking at images. In the majority of cases, it's a multitude of images, but pathology images that give indications for what the patient might have, which would lead to additional ancillary testing, immunohistochemistry that results in additional images. Quite often, it's also correlated with molecular testing. So they would have an NGS assay that they would run before they get to a determination. And quite often, it would also be in consultation with radiologists and the oncologist or other clinician that might be involved. So it's an inherently multimodal decision making process. As you said, classification of these images is almost perfect for a majority of fundamental cancer types, for cancer types or diseases that often get screening, like breast, colon, prostate. We already have existing algorithms that are almost perfect with very high sensitivity. But they have not been actively adapted. And there are a number of different reasons. Pathology inherently is still analog. A majority of hospitals in the US and around the world still use glass slides under a microscope rather than having these images digitized. And there are some other reasons as well. Yeah.
Talk about the multimodal side. You've published on, you know, how to use multimodal data in an intelligent way. Is that an emerging capability that we're figuring out how to use AI to do? And where do we stand? Like, at what point do you think that when I get a pathology study done on, I get moles clipped off because I have a lot of them. Sometimes they get excised. They get looked at under, I think, a microscope. And the person says, yes, good to go or not. Like, at what point will that be a purely digital process relying on some kind of molecular testing?
For me, the most interesting aspect of this, and I've said this repeatedly in my talks, is that the discovery aspect of this is the most interesting for us. Because if you look at throughout the history of pathology or throughout the history of medicine, the way new diseases, new subtypes, new discoveries are made is that someone goes in, looks at lots of pathology cases, comes up with a common morphologic marker and correlates them with outcomes, saying that this is a new disease, this is a new subtype, this is a new grade. And computationally, with all the new self-supervised models, foundation models, we have the capability to extract rich feature representations and correlate them with outcome sort of autonomously, right? So we have this, as more and more data is collected, it can act as your living laboratory where you're continuously making these discoveries. So that's the most interesting aspect. And it becomes very interesting with multimodal data, because you can say that I can use the multimodal data in a number of different ways. I can use it to contrast with my pathology data to improve feature representations for each one of these modalities. But I can also fuse this data to, you know, come up with better outcome predictions. Or I can do a multitude of this and then improve outcome prediction in general, improve treatment response, but also improve the way new discoveries in pathology or medicine in general are made.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the, I think, fascinating things about this stage in AI is if you can use orthogonal data sets to actually improve your understanding of either of the data sets independently, as in kind of the molecular data is interpretable, but there's a lot that we don't understand. And so if you overlay it with pathological data in an intelligent way, it actually might, you know, increase the power of your molecular diagnostics alone relative to what you previously, you know, knew or didn't know.
Absolutely. So in 2022, we published an article in Cancer Cell where we showed that across a multitude of different cancers, when you combine histology with molecular data, you can predict outcome much better. So you can separate patients into distinct risk groups. But an even more interesting finding is that then you can go back and look at what these models are using in making these outcome prediction determinations and how they all correlate with each other. So how does the molecular profile, what's important in the molecular profile, correlate with histology and so forth, right? So it can absolutely enhance our understanding. And at the time, this was the most common way to use multimodal data. What's happened since is that now there are all these different algorithms that were coming out in conventional machine learning where we're seeing that you can contrast across modalities. So you can contrast images with text to improve feature representations for both images and text. And in a way, this makes a lot of sense because this is how humans learn. Pathology trainees, for example, look at these images under a microscope and are hearing about it, they're reading about it, and their understanding of the image is enhanced by all of these language cues. So contrasting images with language in a self-supervised manner fundamentally makes a lot of sense. And we showed in a number of studies, and other people have shown this as well, that by contrasting pathology images with morphologic descriptions, pathology reports, you can enhance both image representation and text representation. And those image representations can then be used for a variety of different downstream tasks. Because the representations are now rich enough, you can use them in a few shot setting for cases, situations where you just don't have enough data available, essentially enabling machine learning for rare diseases, for clinical trials where you have very, very few data points to begin with.
Yeah, maybe the question that I have is just like, where are we today, you know, in terms of the kind of pathology, you know, in terms of like, okay, you were mentioning that we can, you know, see the responders versus like, or like non-responders, but like, can we actually do like a therapy selection based on the pathology data or something like that? Because, you know, for me, we have been really made with kind of liquid biopsy and, you know, liquid biopsy, it can be a few kind of markers, but like, to me, pathology slides, it feels such a rich information that we, you know, that using machine learning or AI, we could be kind of teasing out information. So maybe you can just give us the landscape, what is possible today to do if we apply it.
Computational pathology really touches every part of the, you know, drug discovery process, all the way up to the clinical trial and going into having markers for response to treatment. If you start from the very beginning, of course, machine learning is now being used to parse out very good drug candidates. But once you have those drug candidates, those candidates would typically go through like a toxicologic assessment where you use lots of animal models and you give these animals the drug and over time you would sacrifice them and get some biopsies to see if there's any toxicologic manifestation. And this process is all done manually today, and computational pathology could be used to really accelerate that toxicology assessment component of the drug discovery pipeline. And once you have done this toxicology drug safety study, the next step is efficacy study, which still in the beginning often happens in animal models. In those cases, you can look for markers. Are there any early indications of unimodal, multimodal markers in the images or in molecular data, or a combination of the two that what would indicate a response to treatment? And then once you start your in-human trial, you can use some knowledge that you might have acquired previously by using machine learning. You can now look at every new patient that's enrolled in a trial is a data point that you can use to predict whether the next patient is going to be responsive to the treatment or not. So you can run your trial in a much more intelligent way as to who would be a good candidate to enroll. So few-shot learning could help with that. These richer feature representations allow us to do one-shot, two-shot, three-shot learning, where based on in the beginning just one patient, then two, and as more patients come in, we're predicting which next patient is going to respond. And once your in-human trial is done, so you're able to run your trial much better using these tools, then you can use that trial data to across the entire cohort to see if there was any common morphologic feature across the responders, common molecular feature, and whether they correlated with each other, that can then become like a marker that's used to predict who is going to respond to treatment. So it's incredibly exciting what's coming next, as we have sort of beginning to saturate performance in extracting rich feature representations from these data sets. And pathology goes beyond, pathology images go, or microscopy images in general, just go beyond just the diagnostic process and where computational pathology can essentially help.
It really seems like, or at least from our perspective, we have a forecast that it distills to the power of AI models is going to improve 100 to 1,000-fold over the next 2 or 3 years, given the amount of money pushing into it and all of the low-hanging fruit in terms of improving these models per kind of call it GPU burned to train it. Do you feel that acceleration in capability in your space? As in, do you have like a feeling like, oh, now I can do much more than I could even a year ago or 2 years ago? What does it look like from the perspective of the computational pathologist trying to like practically say, hey, I'm going to drive a research project with the capabilities of these AI systems? What does it feel like to you?
Absolutely. So the developments in this area have happened way faster than I had ever imagined, right? So the things we were able to do this year, if you asked me a year ago, I would have said that we might not be able to get to for another 5 years, right? So we were able to build like a singular multimodal large language model, a chatbot that caters to all of human pathology and really assess and evaluate it. It was just published summer in this year in Nature. And since then, we've expanded it substantially, and we spun out a company and this entire ecosystem around it. And all of this was done in a span of a year and a half. This includes data collection, training, and we're talking about knowledge catering all of human pathology. So it was time consuming. Data collection component, very, very difficult, very lots of manual data curation. But the speed with which we can build these is just amazing. And the other benefit I see is that AI, as you said, would have this enormous impact. But on these very specific subfields, I think it will have a very, very fast impact because, as an example, OpenAI is trying to build a single multimodal large language model that caters to all of human knowledge. We're catering just to pathology, which is much more specific and is like easier to build and validate and go through all the hoops. So I think on these very specific subfields, it will have a much, much faster impact.
I mean, one of the, I guess common criticisms of these AI models is, oh, they're total black boxes. You can't tell what comes out on the back end, but the language interface actually can make them interpretable. As in, like, even if I get genetic results from from a genetic test, often the doctor's like, well, I don't really know how to tell you about this thing because he hasn't read all of the literature. He really can't. And actually, an AI-enabled system could actually make it more parsable both for the doctor and for the inpatient. I'm sure that's kind of like the same is true in pathology, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're looking at and what we're doing. So in the past, when we looked at treatment response cohorts, and these cohorts are often small, and we have, you know, here's our cohort of responders and here's a cohort of non-responders, and we train a machine learning model to predict if there's any separation between the two, or whether we can train a classifier or not. And then we would have to do all kinds of interpretability on top of it by looking at handcrafted features or something. But now with the generative AI tool we have, we call it PathChat, we can just feed it in and it gives us a nice morphologic description for what the model paid attention to in the responder cohort and what was it looking at in the non-responder cohort. And that makes it much easier. Like that communication barrier between computer scientists and pathologists that used to exist has come down so much just by having this large language model available to us.
And maybe going just to your previous kind of answer about, you know, how it can be kind of used throughout the kind of drug discovery, why we are not doing that? Or are there companies, you know, I think I read that AstraZeneca is maybe kind of trying something in the clinical trials to kind of do patient stratification. But, you know, this seems like, if you think about drug discovery, which is a very inefficient process, having tool like this, which could help you really with kind of improving that, you know, the companies would be jumping onto that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think all drug companies are doing it. And I'm familiar with the work you're talking about at AstraZeneca, very familiar with their team. And other drug companies too. All major pharma now have like an image analysis division, and their immediate goal is to find image-based biomarkers, whether unimodal or multimodal, to go with their existing drugs for which trials have already been run. But they're also incorporating image analysis increasingly during the clinical trial process, and then toxicology is also of interest to all of them. Right? So they're absolutely going in that direction. So in the beginning, when I got started in this field, there was obviously a lot of interest on the diagnostic end, but over the years, we've had so much interest from pharma in everything that we do. We have also made a lot of our tools open source. So they're increasingly being used for applications that go beyond just human pathology diagnosis.
To me, as a patient more than a researcher, I'm always sensitive to almost the diagnostic side or more attuned to that. And just thinking about even the way in which my relationship to technological tools that help me interpret health events has changed. And I used to, you know, Google search everything and I'd end up at WebMD and it would say, you probably have cancer, because if you have any set of symptoms, like it leads you to, you know, and now I kind of like dump a doctor's note into ChatGPT and get a much more queryable, interpretable kind of like, you know, description of what's going on with my mother-in-law, for example. I wonder if though the like, we will in the future prefer to be querying a model that is actually trained on the underlying biology rather than a model that is trained on the kind of extent medical literature text, which is basically what ChatGPT is doing. Do you think that kind of like the future state of kind of diagnostic healthcare actually will rely more so on models that actually have had the raw biological data fed into them? Or do you think it's going to always sit at kind of like this almost more, text-based layer?
Yeah, I think it'll be a combination, right? So I think what OpenAI has done is that they've probably used all of medical literature that's out there. And the medical literature in textbooks or online or, you know, in UpToDate and all of these other repositories is a surrogate for the underlying biology, as you mentioned. And that's fine because it's interpretable, it's easy to read, it can parse it down given the language capabilities that the LLM has. But what would happen in the future, in my opinion, is that there will be dedicated models for specific purposes that then interface with like a generalist large language model, right? So these specific models might be pre-prompted if they are multimodal large language models to make a diagnosis or other kinds of tasks, or they could also be really well trained supervised models that then that interface with the large language model. Essentially, you have this sort of agentic setup where it's essentially a number of AI agents all communicating with each other, and this each particular agent is an expert in a particular domain. So you could have one an expert in a pathology domain and a radiology domain, and they're trained on underlying biological data or medical data, and then you have this text model on top of it, and then they both communicate with the text model and back and forth, right? Similar to what would happen, for example, in a tumor board where pathologists, radiologists, oncologists would all get together and finalize the diagnostic and treatment path for a patient.
Just a question on the kind of diagnostic kind of front. You know, I think you mentioned in the beginning that kind of pathology today is pretty analog still. You know, how do you see actually change of the pathology in actual kind of clinic and diagnostic? Kind of, you know, because I've seen your papers. I think there are some other kind of papers as well, especially with the computational models kind of, you know, doing this for pathology. But how do you actually see that kind of really going into clinic and being kind of everyday use?
A majority of pathology is still analog. And there are a number of different reasons for this. The first reason has to do with training. Most pathologists are trained on analog microscopes, and that's how they like to do things. But there are also a lot of pathologists who would love to see digital pathology adoption. The key reason that I feel is that the value proposition is not there for the hospitals to make that large upfront investment in going digital. There hasn't been enough FDA approved machine learning algorithms that cater to primary diagnosis. There's one FDA approved algorithm for the prostate that caters to secondary diagnosis, and that means that a pathologist would first need to analyze it, and then they can be confirmed by machine learning. But it's all changing very fast. And another reason is around reimbursements. Up until recently, there was no reimbursement codes for digital pathology and for downstream machine learning. So I think all of this is coming together. So this now is the right time. Most large academic medical centers have either gone digital or will be going digital very, very soon, but they only make up a small fraction of all the pathology that's done in the country. The smaller pathology practices, it might take a little bit more time to go digital. And once everything is digital, then using these AI models would become much more easier. The flow would be much more established, in particular with regards to reimbursements, because there's always this question that who's going to pay for this, right? Especially if it's not leading to a reduction in costs.
The process of going digital is basically just investing the CapEx into digital microscopy. Is that and is that a very big expense, really, relative to, or it's just an expense relative to right now they have fully depreciated equipment that they can use?
It's not an enormous expense. It is an expense. You need slide scanners, you need personnel, and you need storage to basically do this. Yeah.
As you described it, it's kind of like pathology is very fragmented. There are these small practices. But once, if you have a slide, couldn't you effectively have a slide scanner and then more centralized kind of pathology practices using advanced AI tools, and the whole, call it, service of pathology will consolidate as a function of this?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So I think this is where it's going. This is also what we want to do here at MGB, where we'll have a central lab, and all of our hospitals, all the pathology departments at MGB, would then get the digital slides, and pathologists would just look at the digital slides. So it is going in that direction. In terms of the cost is associated with the slide scanners, the storage, and the personnel to run it. It can add up quite substantially, particularly if you would like to keep the archival storage. And there's some mandates for how long you have to keep the images or the glass slides. But the potential benefits of discovery, potential intellectual property that could be created once everything is digital and all the archival slides are digital is just enormous.
Yeah, I mean, if you all don't want to pay to keep the archival data, I will happily take it off your hands, because I suspect it will become quite valuable over time. Like, it seems like there's definitely, like, if we're developing like AI models on the basis of this data, I don't think you want to throw away the data, you know?
I think over the years I've been thinking about, you know, there are a lot of different business models, value proposition that could be made for for this particular purpose, if you look at the two biggest costs, you know, there's obviously the initial infrastructure cost, but then there's a continuous storage cost. So if you have similar to like the kind of the Flatiron model where someone's, you know, covering all of those or all of those costs in return for the data being stored and easily accessible to the hospitals in an anonymized way, it could be a viable business model. But yeah, that's exciting.
What was your experience? How big a bottleneck is the data that you need? You know, is this like, you know, is this like we have enough, or like, you know, there are still kind of edge cases that we are missing because we don't have enough kind of data to train the foundational models?
From recent machine learning literature, we know that the diversity of data is way more important than the quantity of data. So what we did was that we manually collected a lot of data. We put in a lot of effort in finding the most diverse cases that existed across Brigham and MGH and other hospitals, and scanned those particular cases to build the foundation models. There have been some other parallel efforts where they've used lots of screening data. And we've seen that even when you use lots and lots of additional data going up to the millions of cases, the performance improvement is not huge, or there's basically no improvement in certain cases. And that's because they did not use enough diverse data, right? So that was sort of our strategy in collecting the data for those foundation models. And the reason they work so well, the foundation models we developed, they were made publicly available. They were open source with the articles, and they've been downloaded over a million times. They've heavily cited, used for basically every disease model for which there's public data out there.
You're kind of at a point of acceleration. And so perhaps this is hard to answer, but like 3 years forward or 5 years forward, like what do you think you're going to be working on, or how far will the field have advanced? Is kind of like the patient side going to be like, oh, all pathology is now digitally diagnostic because it's so much more powerful than the way we were doing before? And on the research side, is it basically like, you know, all of this information is feeding into basically every clinical program in some way? Like, how do you think about pace of progress, what you would be working on, and how the industry will receive kind of these advances?
I think what would happen on the pathology side is that everything would be digital. And with the foundation models for these individual modalities would saturate in performance. They're already beginning to saturate. And we would use these foundation models or large self-supervised models to extract rich features from every pathology image that's scanned. And that opens up a whole array of possibilities. You can then use those features for downstream machine learning models. You can use them to integrate in a multimodal way with other kinds of data. And you can, more importantly, use it for discovery. So as you have more and more data, you can make interesting discoveries, more markers, more disease models, and so forth. So I think that's what would happen on the pathology side. In general, I think that what would happen with the overall spectrum of healthcare is that we would get to patient level representations. So we would have, you know, rich feature extraction from every modality, from pathology, radiology, electronic medical records, and every patient would have a single representation that's continuously updated in time as additional events are included. So if someone is, you know, on immunotherapy and has a toxicity event over the weekend, their feature vector is a little bit different now. So that would be indicative of their outcome, but also searching through large amounts of patients, finding similar patients, and then figuring out how their trajectory was, right? So all of this is, I'm not even projecting 3 years out. This is like a year out, right? Based on the tools that just in my lab, what we have today, right? So all of this would exist. How long it would take to put into clinical practice, that just depends on how quickly the regulatory framework changes, because it's clear that regulation has not kept up pace with which we are sort of developing on the machine learning end.
That is, as from the investor side and probably from the clinician side, but certainly from the system-wide perspective, that always seems to be this particular industry, given how really complex and fragmented the payer system is and the regulatory system is, takes time to like actually have what are seem to be obvious kind of like health advances actually get deployed into practice in a widespread way.
I actually wanted to ask you just the kind of intersection of the kind of, you know, computational pathology, ordinal pathology with kind of spatial methods that have been kind of very popular, you know, kind of spatial genomics, because kind of it's imaging and the molecular data together. And how do you see those two areas?
Yeah, that's a great question. We've recently done quite a lot of work in that area. So as you know, that a lot of the spatial methods are quite expensive. And more recently, people have started to pay attention that you can get spatial transcriptomics, spatially localized genomic information, and correlate it with histology, right? So people are beginning to look at whether you can predict spatial gene expression directly from histology. So that opens up a possibility where you can do your discovery with the spatial transcriptomics correlated with histology. But once that discovery is done, you make the actual prediction from H&E, which is like orders of magnitude cheaper. So that's like a model that is likely to be very, very successful. The other big thing I think that's coming, and we have put out some early indicators of that in an article that would be published in Neurips, that people would begin to use histology and spatial transcriptomics in a correlative manner, such as to improve feature presentations on the image end. And that's particularly very exciting because we have shown in a number of different studies, and this is what the community is sort of proving over and over again, is that contrasting images with text leads to better representations. Then we showed that contrasting with transcriptomics leads to better image representations, and contrasting with IHCs leads to better representations. So if this all of this is true, spatial transcriptomics represents like the ultimate ground truth of this, right? So contrasting ST with H&E should give you the richest feature representation possible. And then you could use that feature representation for a variety of different downstream tasks, some that were never, could never be solved kind of otherwise, like very fine-grained segmentation and so forth.
My PhD was in a Aviv Regev lab, and one of my lab mates, during his PhD, he was trying to do what you first were trying to describe. Basically, you know, if I have images, can I just, and you know, train the model to on the kind of ST data? Can I actually be predicting? At that time, I mean, you know, this was 2017, 2018, 2019. It was not there. It was not near there, kind of.
I love how you describe a PhD's 3 years of life evaporating, like 2017, 18, 19. That's the way research projects go, right?
How do you think generally about, you know, maybe I actually saw a few days ago, there was a paper where I think James Zhou from the Stanford, where they made a kind of virtual lab where you have like agents who are doing the research. How do you see something like that actually changing the science? You know, me being doing a PhD and everything, like we were those LLM agents in the labs, right? The PhD students and the postdocs, and now each PhD postdoc have their own army of LLM agents doing this stuff. You know, is that the near future, and how is it going to change the productivity of the science?
It is. It's going to be in the near future. I think James put out like a very good example of it, and it's being built at a very accelerated pace. Basically, everybody is trying to build these agents to accelerate research. The company that we started, they also have an agent that caters to all kinds of research in computational pathology. I think that there'll be agents that are specific to these fields that come out first because you're targeting a very specific problem. And then over time, there'll be a multitude of agents that all communicate with each other, similar to how what you have in a research team, bind it together, perhaps by a large language model to accomplish a certain task, right? So let me give an example to that. In computational biology, we often use fixed existing code to do a lot of different things. If you have an agent that can use those existing libraries and write a little bit of additional code to patch them together, you essentially have a computational biologist as an agent that can do your entire task. And the tool that we developed, as an example, if you have a cohort of responders and non-responders, and you want to classify whether you can predict who will respond or not, you can just simply give a text prompt that here's my cohort, here's where it's located, and it would make a plan. It would come up with a list of tasks that it needs to essentially do, and this would include tissue segmentation and tissue patching and feature extraction, all things that have existing code. It just figured out in what sequence to run it, and perhaps there's some small code that needs to be written, and we can use GPT-4o to write that additional code. You bring it all together, and now you have an agent that's essentially doing what, for example, a trainee would do in a research lab, right? So these capabilities are likely to get better and better.
Yeah. Well, I definitely look forward to, seeing the rate pace of advance, like, translate hopefully into, like, real-world applications for patients, but also on the research side. I mean, it seems like, you know, are one of my high-level kind of takeaways from almost every time we dig into biological science is we are still so early at understanding how the body works, and kind of like we're just at the very like thinnest uppermost layer of a vast sea of complexity. And so it's like we need these tools to better understand what's going on and to have like a more precise kind of prescription for, you know, how to maintain and extend life.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree with that. I think that, you know, all of these are very complex systems, right? And humans can only study these complex systems, one at a time, and good science is difficult and hard and time consuming. And so with these agents, at least the computational aspect of the science could be accelerated substantially.
Yeah. Well, Faisal, I really appreciate you taking the time and enjoyed the conversation. We look forward to future publications in the future from you. And I guess if you're a pathologist, you should try out the pathology chat tool, or is it for the end public?
it's past chat, and we hope to make it available broadly available very, very soon. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, great. Thanks for coming on. Thank you for listening to this episode of FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button and make sure to leave a comment down below letting us know what you thought. And if you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe to the show and follow us at ARK Invest on your favorite social platforms so you stay up to date whenever we drop a new episode.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.